Du lytter nå til et opptak av Forum for vitenskap og demokrati. Innledningen er av Dieter Pleve, seniorforsker ved Wissenschaftszentrum Berlin. Møteleder er Tor Halvorsen, førsteamanuensis ved Universitetet i Bergen. Møtet ble holdt ved Universitetsmuseet i Bergen 21.3.2024. Arrangementet ble avholdt på engelsk.
Det er en glede å velkomme Dieter Pleve en gang mer til dette forum. For science and democracy. Dieter was here in 2009 when we discovered his fantastic book together with Mirovsky, The Road from Montpellier. It was a book that was sort of waking us up to the influence and the enormous, well-coordinated role of the think tanks, particularly the neoliberal think tanks that influenced us much more than we were aware of, I must say, before we read this book. And Dieter has worked on these issues of think tanks and neoliberalism the last 20 years, I would say, maybe more, and has also written follow-up books together with Quinn Slobodian, this one, Nine Lives of Neoliberalism, which you can buy here, and this book, Market Civilization, where also we have contribution from a Norwegian, Lars Mjøset. So he has coordinated and influenced, Herr Tord comes with a cable, to influenced the debate on think tanks throughout the world, and is now very well-renowned researcher on this field. And the issue today is the relationship between think tanks and universities, and all the and the issue of all the professors that choose to work for think tanks. And as we know, there is a in the media, the think tanks seems to be much more popular than universities, and think tanks are more used by politicians than university academics. So what is the relation between university knowledge and think tanks, and why are so many academics, professors, joining think tanks and expressing themselves as think tank academics, what we could call policy academics or something like that? So Dieter Pleve, he works at Wissenschaftszentrum Berlin, which was started just after the Second World War as a thing, as almost a think tank, as a center for study of management and leadership, but has developed quite broadly lately. And he's now at SCOS in Sweden doing research on the Atlas network. So, Dieter, without further talk from my side, please go ahead.
Thank you very much.
You can stand up here.
Probably need I can take this along and I can maybe just do like this. Thank you very much for having me twice here. It's a long time ago, so I'm really, really glad to be back. Also, when I received then the details and saw the hour of the presentation, I thought, oh, this is a new academic format. And it reminded me that, in fact, in Germany, we now do things like long nights of science, where we have people come sort of like at midnight to look at some labs and at some presentations. And so here you do it in differently, you do it in the early morning, where basically I felt, okay, this is then the church is coming back, no? Church has this midnight mass and the morning devotional, and I felt like, okay, this is my job. I have to give you the morning devotional today. And in this age of secularization, it's kind of nice to see that some of the formats are coming back. I'm really, really happy. It was a very one of the great encounters here with the colleagues in Norway, Tour and Atle and others in the work, which is indeed very long running on this global network of neoliberal, organized neoliberals and think tanks that we are talking about. And so today, given the title that that tour wanted, I talk a little bit about the relationship between the university and the think tank and the role of the professor, I guess, but not only, I guess. When I thought about it, and when we think of these different formats of organizations, you know, think tanks on the one hand and universities on the other hand, I remembered this saying by Kurt Tucholsky, who had this wonderful poem where this sentence, "Here a chair, there a chair, and us always in between." And that I felt is sort of like a kind of a nice opening for thinking about the different types of organizations. Of course, when we think of the university professor, we think of Professor Smart, you know, who is like the person who has a lot of wisdom, researched all his life, and is teaching to the students all the time. Whereas if we think of the think tank, we think more of the Dr. Smart, the young, maybe professional, who is more like a consultant than in a way sort of like akin to the professor. And if we think of the different organizations a bit more, then of course we have important differences. No, the university is super old, first one from Bologna, with some predecessors in old Greece. We of course know that universitas, the name already refers to the community of all the learning, so it's a very broad effort. We know that university is much about issues of truth, reflections on epistemology, how can we understand the world, how can we explain the world, very committed to critical reflection on how far does certain approaches to science get us, and so on and so forth. We know that university is also very much about theory. It's not about just details. It's about things that we know enough about so that we can generalize, that we feel comfortable in generalizing. And then, of course, we also know it's about a development of adequate methods to go after these subjects. I mean, that has changed dramatically when I recently looked actually at the origins of the Fabian Society, one of the early think tanks of the left, founded in the UK, and they actually had a book on method because they basically invented an early social science method, which is very interesting to read nowadays because it was all about collecting information from practitioners, doing interviews systematically, and relating the relation and talking about the thinking about the relationship between practitioners and institutions. And this was sort of like developed in a book on social science method in the 1920s. And they basically say, okay, we know nothing about statistics. So they basically made a big case about their method being very systematic and being very different from the methods of math and statistics. And so it's very worthwhile looking back at even the evolution of some of the methodology and the reflections what they give us. So very much an academic endeavor to develop methods, think about methods to make sure that some of the stuff we are finding, we can trust that it's more or less correct until somebody else comes and has a convincing argument and method to show us that it's not. I think one of the most important things, of course, is quality control. No, peer review doesn't always work. We also know the downsides, but it's a deliberate effort to actually not leave things to the chance of basically just an individual effort. And what I think is almost most important in comparison is that I think the knowledge process in university, the traditional university, is question driven. We want to know things. We actually do not know about things. I mean, we want to teach the PhD students, the normal students, that it's all about finding out what is not known well and where to devote efforts to actually bring new light into things. So it's very much, it should be, and in many areas it is, very much a question-driven project. And and then of course forever the question of relevance. No, on the one hand we have the super relevance of the well-recognized and well-esteemed colleagues who publish many books and sort of like get into TV and become sort of like get lots of honors and so on and so forth. And then on the other hand, we have, of course, thousands and thousands and thousands of research where basically we don't exactly know who's actually reading it, who is you know, who finds it interesting, who finds it relevant. The other day at SCAS, when a linguist talked about invented languages and was very ironical, suggesting that one of the new invented languages has a certain following of two on the internet, mocking a bit the effort, I thought much better about my publications that have a few references only. No? And of course, we all know, it's sometimes things get recognized very much and very well that maybe don't deserve it, and a lot of things get remain pretty much unknown, even though they might deserve a lot of recognition. So, very complicated issue. The think tank instead. Well, the first think tank, many people think tanks come from the United States still to this day, even though we have written quite a bit about why this is actually nonsense. It was maybe talked first about in the United States, and it was talked first about in the United States after or during the time of the Vietnam War. Why? Because suddenly the ways in which private research organizations like RAND, previously part of Lockheed, in California, were actually doing war-relevant research in sort of like support of the war effort in Vietnam, which was, of course, many students and many people opposed the horrors of the Vietnam War. And suddenly it was questioned, is that actually something academics, researchers at institutions should do? So they talked about in very negative ways about what the think tank of RAND was doing in support of the military effort. And in this moment, the term think tank was used as a pejorative label on this way of doing science. What were the think tanks that existed known as before the term was negatively used? They were research institutes. And now, is the research institute an American invention? I doubt it. Of course, it was all around, and as early as the time of the Wilhelminic Germany, the Kiel Institute was also already existing as a privately funded research institute in Germany, so deserving in a way a similar label of think tank. But it's actually then a good example of the hierarchies of knowledge in a changing world, post-war hegemony of the United States, and sort of like relevant things all come from the United States, regardless if they do or don't. So the first think tanks in the modern way we think of them nowadays, of course, are from the 70s, actually. Why? Because after the term was first used negatively, pejoratively, organizations were founded that basically managed to turn this negative connotation around and use it again in a bit of a positive way, borrowed from the appeal of science, of academia, and sort of like suggested they go beyond the normal university by making knowledge more relevant. Organizations like the Heritage Foundation, organizations, other particularly right-wing think tanks at the time understood the limits of traditional university or institute-based research, where the scientists were taking time, studying a subject, publishing a study without much regard to the relevance of this research for the policy process, for the larger world. So, for example, an American Enterprise Institute study on some military effort was published long after the decision with regard to which it was relevant was taken. And then basically Ed Foellner and a few others in this neoliberal universe understood they need to change the method of doing research. They need to be doing research in recognition of policy processes, of decision-making, decisive decision-making points, and that was when Heritage Foundation was born and started to do research with an eye to the Congress and with an eye to the decision maker. So it was became famous that Heritage basically produced very small pieces of paper where it was basically explained why the representative in Congress should vote this way or that way. The material had to pass the briefcase test. It should fit in here. That's, of course, the time when we know that traditional academia is lost, no? Publish big books that never fit on small pieces of paper. And of course, the traditional output in modern think tanks is like the short policy brief, maybe 2 or 3 pages. I now see that many times people are not really reading much more, even university people, reading not much more than 1 page. No, I mean, it's sort of like the maximum that that one can hope to be digestible. So the core is policy-related research and consulting in think tanks. In my definition, I mean, there's notoriously, basically, it's impossible to give one precise definition. I decided that I don't bother anymore, that we can take the think tank function, which at the core is policy-related research and advice, and don't care so much about the organizational format. So if an organization has to do with policy-related research and consulting, I consider it relevant for think tank research. My way to get around the organizational definition is also that I don't think of think tanks as isolates. I think of them as networks. And then we frequently find that think tanks operate in conjunction with other organizations. So basically, a think tank network has much to do with policy-related research and consulting, no matter if it's just a think tank or if it's two think tanks or three think tanks or three think tanks and a university institute and so on and so forth. It's basically relevant that we know what we talk about rather than struggle about definitions that that do not work. Here we have absolutely a truth claim without much epistemological or science philosophical reflection. Think tankers simply claim that they know the truth, that they support the argument with the best knowledge. We have certainly theory and generalization, but it's frequently really unidirectional. So in comparison to university, where we usually have competing paradigms, at least in good universities, in think tanks, we have usually a very narrow spectrum, which, you know, depending on what kind of organization it is not surprising. We have increasingly this method claim that it's evidence-based, whatever that means, because it's not peer-reviewed and not quality-controlled, but it's sort of like a claim that, of course, is made to appeal to the kind of academic scientific relevance. One of the big differences to the question-driven research is that it's actually answer-driven. You know, policy-related research and advice sets out to advise people on something, so claiming we know what is best and we know the answer, we know what you should do. So you will hardly find in think tank publications a reflection on the limits of knowledge, on alternative solutions, on, you know, it may exist, but I mean the major project is of course to be convinced that my neoliberal market-based solution is the best. You know, it's simply the best, you have nothing better, so please use it. Relevance, well, again, of course, there's now hundreds and thousands of think tanks around the world, and some of them are very well known and very important. We know that the Heritage Foundation, in conjunction with many other think tanks in Project 25, is now setting up the basically research program for Trump, should he be elected. You can already read quite a bit of what is going to happen in department by department. It was started under Ronald Reagan. The Heritage Foundation did the first mandate for leadership publication for Ronald Reagan, basically. And sort of like many other think tanks are not much more than an address somewhere, if at all. So they don't even have a physical presence. It's basically unclear sometimes what exactly is there. So it's an empirical question to find out, in a way, about the relevance of this and that. You cannot say it in general. It would all be so easy if it would be really this one organization here, the think tank, and the one organization here, the university, no? Then we could sort of like settle for, okay, we like to be academics, so we go to universities. We like to be consultants, so we work at the think tank. But, of course, in the world, we have different university systems. We have the differentiated academic system of Germany, for example, with the general science universities and the basic science research institutes, Max Planck, Leibniz Gesellschaft. And then we have applied science organizations, the Fraunhofer Institutes, and we have Helmholtz and many others. And of course, we have the WZB was actually founded in the 80s, had some predecessors post-war, but the WZB itself was founded in the 1980s and was asked to do something we call problem-oriented social science. Why problem-oriented social science? Because traditional university science was considered to be too remote from the real world, too ivory tower type of research. So we were asked to do problem-oriented science, which was supposed to be sort of like a small step out of the ivory tower in the real world, but not too far. Sort of like, you know, remain committed to the basic science principle, but yes, do it in light of what is relevant in society. Have debates about, you know, what kind of relevant problems we had. Have in the 1980s, it was very much about the labor market. That's the time when Tour, I think, came across the WZB, for example. Later, it became, of course, much concerned with the transformation process from socialism to capitalism. You should think nowadays, with the problem of climate change and the problem of, you know, the various multi-crisis processes in the world and global capitalism, finance, you should think that should then become a huge issue at WZB. But then you discover not all the problems that exist in the world are then becoming a mandate of the research. And so certain topics are then also subject to science political selection. What is considered relevant? How do we go for it? Instead, in British universities, American universities, you find universities that have actually all these different elements, basic science, applied science, and so on, under one roof. You don't have a differentiated system so much, but you have actually space at the normal university for all kinds of different things. If you go to British universities, you might find a seminar run by Ernst & Young, and or a seminar run by a professor in conjunction with Ernst & Young on lobbying. The early lobby research on European lobbying was actually done very much in conjunction with Ernst & Young, which you know, saw an expanding market and found professors with whom they could develop the research program. Then, of course, we talk about the commercialization of science. So you could basically name many universities nowadays after their main sponsor, Shell University or BP University or whatever. And it's a kind of a funny process. Now it goes ever deeper into the university, even like special rooms are named after companies and so on and so forth. And there was a project by Transparency International and TUTS, I don't know why they abandoned it, where they wanted to systematically capture the relationships between German or corporations in Germany, not only German corporations, and the university research, but unfortunately they dropped it because it's probably also very difficult because there's so much to do, no? I mean, so it's very difficult and very important issue to look at who is actually funding, sponsoring, and in that way, of course, in many ways also directing science nowadays. Examples, energy research, you know, the continuing relevance of nuclear, the continuing relevance of fossil energies despite the Paris goals and so on and so forth. In economics, I mean, finance, we had the global financial crisis, the collapse almost of the world economy. And what do we have? I mean, we're pretty much back in the hands of BlackRock and many other of these huge financial corporations. So the question, you know, is university really doing the research, or in which ways is financialization research, yeah, maybe not subject of the kind of traditional mode of research we tend to crave for? Well, we have the mode two model of knowledge production, which has been discussed here as well a lot, where the claim is that this differentiation of research, I mean, Luhmann and others talked about the increasing specialization, differentiation, and then we see that nowadays actually the borders that the system theory radical approach erected seem to collapse. No, it's unclear where the world of business ends, where the world of university begins, where the world of politics ends, where the world of politics business begins, and so on and so forth. Now, the mode two people, Novotny and others, they claim this is good. The mode two is sort of like a wonderful process of an ever broader contribution to knowledge production, and where rather, I dare say, uncritical about all these processes, where it's absolutely true the world is, in terms of knowledge production, de-differentiating, but it's unclear what of it is good and what is bad, and it should be subject to critical research to find out more about it. And I would say, nevertheless, despite all these kind of lines blurred between also specifically the world of think tank research and academic research, there are differences. There's a difference in the core mission, the kind of long-termish research effort, the kind of teaching, education, research nexus, and so on and so forth of the university. Of course, universities have a very specific function in society. We have different venues of communication to a certain extent. I mean, we uphold academic journals to some with a lot of effort that are working quite a bit different from the kind of template we get from think tanks. Also, think tanks now have started to publish their own academic journals. The Institute of Economic Affairs, neoliberal think tanks were quite good at founding, which is also unsurprising because if you're long enough in academic research, you know that those research perspectives that get sidelined in the mainstream found a new journal. So, of course, it's also a typical process of competition. The audiences, I think, are quite a bit different. Academic community is still like very much devoted to academic conversations, even if there is an opening to the larger world. Under the pressure of think tanks, the fastest growing department at WZB has been the media and communications department, not the research department. Of course, think tank people, they can be considered talking to communities of practice, practitioners in certain fields, everybody who's considered relevant from the perspective of policy processes and so on and so forth. So what about the people, the think tanker in the university and the professor at the think tank? Here is basically the core argument I want to make, that Tom Medvedz, maybe our best researcher on the concept of think tanks, who basically his work has established that think tanks have become a sphere, a social sphere in their own, sort of like have created a, what Bourdieu calls an organizational space of their own. And he claims very much in his study, which is a really great book, very highly recommended, showing that the think tanks were extremely relevant in shifting the paradigm of research on poverty, on inequality and poverty at the time, early 80s, Ronald Reagan shifting, of course, introducing the reduction of the welfare state, starting workfare, and so on and so forth. And before that happened, the key paradigm in academia to think about poverty was deprivation. Certain classes, certain groups of people were deprived from the normal participation in society because of whatever, lack of schooling, lack of jobs, and so on and so forth. And you need adequately, of course, certain amounts of redistribution and support, affirmative action, and so forth. So deprivation was the key paradigm organizing, ordering the field of research by thousands of researchers in the field, of course. Now, this was replaced by a neoliberal effort that culminated in Charles Murray's book, Losing Ground on the American Welfare State, published by the Manhattan Institute, one of the notorious right-wing think tanks. And that book argues that welfare leads to poverty. The welfare regime is to be blamed for the poverty. So instead of the dependency, instead of the deprivation paradigm, it was the dependency paradigm. Push people off the welfare benefits and they will start to work and they will escape poverty in a very short way. And that actually shifted not only the practice under Ronald Reagan and many other other leaderships, but also the whole research was shifted in terms of looking at the ways in which allegedly the welfare system kept people from improving their own lot, and was very much, of course, focused on individual behaviors, on, you know, not on this kind of systemic inequalities and so on and so forth. So here we have a case where arguably, of course, a think tank researcher and a think tank organized publication was tremendously influential in basically helping to shift the university research. And Medvedz basically in his book in a way acknowledges this and thinks of the role of a person like Charles Murray, however, not as a researcher, as an academic, but more or less as a lobbyist. And he wants to basically maintain a notion of autonomy for the university-based professor. In his like reasoning, there is really a big difference between the classical intellectual, the classical research autonomous professor who is working at a university, being sort of like shielded from too many influences, whereas basically people like Murray and others are considered to be part of the kind of linkages in society that steal them their autonomy, so to speak. So he says think tanks, that was on his influence. It's very important that he recognized that it was not just Murray's single publication and like a billiard ball. I push one policy proposal and then the whole thing changed on it, but it was basically a culmination of a long process in which not only Murray and Manhattan Institute was involved, but many other think tanks as well. And so if Medvedz would be right, we would still have sort of like the classical professor autonomous academic research thinking, research practicing at university, and then we would have this world of, you know, shambles where all kinds of things happen and have nothing to do. Now, is that true? Can we really think of the professor at university as the autonomous researcher and the others being sort of like dependent? Or do we have to think of the people as having actually many hats on their head? Which is not necessarily something bad, you know. It's basically just the fact that we live in life, and maybe in the morning we are family fathers or mothers, and then we go to work, and of course we have a job to do, and then we might be active in a political party, so we will take a function in this regard. And so the idea that we have different hats is not so surprising and not so bad, honestly. And in terms of the role of the intellectual, of course, is the question, can you preserve autonomy at university if you're very involved in think tank type research efforts? In which ways do you keep the barrier? Like the consultancies always claim they are able, if they work for different competing customers, they say, oh, we can do this, no problem. In the morning I work for Mercedes-Benz, in the afternoon for VW, but I keep sort of like a clear line between those jobs. They try to pretend to the customers, and of course we know it's complete bullshit, but it's a sort of like a kind of a typical organizational argument, no? And so can the university professor who works in day job in university and does autonomous research and then in the afternoon advises think tank research, can that be done, or is that problematic? I mean, many people do that. I have found Lobby Control, an organization that was trying to increase the transparency of lobbying in Germany. So of course I was also a bit of an activist in terms of the effort to get more knowledge about lobbyists and their practices in Germany and in the EU. And at the same time, I have research publications on the transformation of European lobbying. So I'm not saying this is only the thing that neoliberals do. I think lots of people, progressive people, left-wing people, right-wing people, share this kind of phenomenon. And of course, we can reflect on all kinds of aspects, you know, what should be done, how should this be done, is it okay, is it not okay, and so on and so forth. If we remain in this perspective of looking at it from the individual person, then it's like one perspective we can think of. But if we look at it from a systemic perspective, what in society happens if all kinds of people, universities, professors, join think tanks and so on and so forth, then we get to see something else. No? We see not the individual deciding and having problems to decide. We see how the structure of the field sort of like is organized. If we do that, and I can show you some results of our research on the Atlas Network, we get to see basically the pattern that we have in the world. And this is only for the group of neoliberal think tanks now, so if we would do a complete picture, we would need to include all kinds of others as well. But if we do the Atlas think tanks, which have 500 organizations worldwide, there were only 120 organizations by the time of the financial crisis. So globally, neoliberal right-wing think tanks were quadrupling from 2008 onward. We all thought that the global financial crisis had ended neoliberalism. The people who organize, who are invested in neoliberalism, organized very strongly to defend neoliberalism and increased their capacity. And if we look at the links between think tanks of this Atlas Network and universities, we see a big difference between the world regions. Africa, MENA, 50 professors sit on think tank boards. Oceania, Asia, 79, there might be a few more. But we see in North America, we have more than 1,000 people from universities sitting on boards of think tanks. Okay, the United States is a big country. Europe, similar number of inhabitants, has half the number. So the practice seems to be much more prevalent in the United States than in Europe, but still Europe also has quite a few people who are both active at the level of university and in these think tanks. And if we look by discipline, then we see, of course, that a very strong share in these links in the neoliberal networks are in economics. Not only, we also see it quite a number of other disciplines, law, political science, but it's quite evident that there's a strong concentration in the sort of like economics field. It's actually very interesting. In Europe, we have a much stronger concentration of economists. In Latin America, for example, there's a much broader spectrum of disciplines of neoliberals. So we have a much more traditional pattern of intellectuals, sort of like in Europe, it looks like almost like neoliberal think tanks are sort of like another tool of economists that wield power at university and then can also extend that influence in other areas. If we look in Germany, for example, where we all know that we suffer from the debt brake mechanism, and Germany is even now more keen to save on the budget than to invest in all kinds of areas. We looked at the 150 people who sit on German advisory boards, the ministry advisory boards in finance and economics, and the our Council of Economic Advisers. So between 1980 and now, there were 150 people, very few women. So most of these economists are men. And an overwhelming share of them, in terms of the positions we were able to sort of like find in terms of from their publications, they shared the idea that you need to be austerity minded, that you should not increase taxes, that you should, if possible, lower the expenses and so on and so forth. Now, if we look at, so we have a very strong asymmetry in terms of the economic advisory people in Germany, the professors that sit at university and in such state advisory bodies, very strong bias in favor of neoliberal supply-side economics. Now, if you look at their participation in think tanks, we see that many individuals sit in one think tank, Stiftung Marktwirtschaft, so it's one of these typical German neoliberal think tanks, have many positions and sit on all the three councils we studied. And you have a whole range of people, a whole range of think tanks, Haie Gesellschaft Aktion, this is a very old one, already founded in the 1950s to support Ludwig Erhard. We have, of course, Bruegel in Brussels, Econ Watch. This list goes on and on. Many people sitting on all kinds of American organizations, Aspen, Brookings, here at the European Center for Public Choice is important. Public Choice is a very influential academic school in this area. And it's basically the impression you should get. German economic professors who sit on German advisory councils in the ministries of finance and economics and in the Council of Economic Advisers sit also on many neoliberal conservative think tanks. Those people we found who hold the other position, more like a Keynesian, you know, don't be against austerity, sit on 5 think tanks. The Keynes Society, or 6, not all of them very progressive, the World Economic Forum being one of them where you can find all kinds of people. So the difference in Germany between the professors who are officially charged with advising the government on economic policy, who are in favor of austerity and linked to this neoliberal think tank world, and those who are opposed, is extreme. It's very, very asymmetric. If we would have a bit of a pluralist picture, we should have probably like roughly half and half, no? Sort of like people who are sitting on all kinds of different organizations. We just published this, so we'll see what happens. I did take a quick look at the Norwegian participant in the Atlas Network, Civita. You probably all know them. If you look at Civita's advisory board, you see a strong presence of the University of Oslo, some people from Bergen, some other people, and those people who are not professors are actually from the business world, sort of like from different banks, employers, associations. So if you think of think tanks, of course, leaving the individual perspective, you know, do I do a good thing by combining my academic job with sort of like a policy advisory lobby job? Then, of course, you reflect on what the individual motivations are. You know, a liberal can be very motivated to say we need more freedom in society and so on and so forth. If you look at it as a pattern of the link between the think tank and the society, then, of course, you see a little bit of a different picture. You see how a think tank is embedded in constituencies, in people that fund the think tank, in the case of Civita, very probably the major Norwegian firms and business associations, and other constituencies like academic constituencies or worldview perspectives that you can actually then identify probably by looking closer at the university, people who are involved. And so it's a very different perspective. I mean, you know, no individual is basically to be blamed to be a villain or to be a bad person. The motivations can be very good. But nevertheless, of course, you're a part of a link between civil society and politics that is a particular part in society. And internationally, Civita, of course, is linked through the Atlas Network to the most notorious deniers of climate change, the Heartland Institute. So Civita is as much a part of the Atlas Network as the Heartland Institute. And I'm sometimes wondering if some of these people who are not climate deniers, if they should actually be very happy about being sharing the organizational space, membership, partnership with these organizations. I would very much like to talk to the Civita people if they actually, how they rationalize about being in the same network as people who are very notorious about climate denial and so on and so forth. Here I describe a little bit, this is not just my own work, but lots of people involved because we study this global network, which is 500 organizations, 20,000 people. So quite a bit of empirical work here. This man is the founder of the Atlas Network, who brought it to life in the 1980s on the advice of Friedrich August von Hayek. He founded the Institute of Economic Affairs and later the Atlas Network, which now is this global network of 500 organizations. And an artist I know, Andreas Siegmann, who is now a professor with his wife in Vienna, he did the late project was creating 50 heads of neoliberals and including, of course, Anthony Fisher on wheels, the person who has been personally involved very much in setting up all these think tanks in the world. So basically, when you look at the Atlas Network now, in the beginning, we thought really it's mostly about think tanks. And then we were always wondering, Jesus Christ, but what else is in there? It's really not just think tanks. It's all kinds of organizations, including whole universities. Very early on, the Buckingham University in the UK was a part of the Atlas Network. It was founded by neoliberals. The Montparnasse Society people were heavily involved, and they were apparently very much involved in the early Atlas projects. They're no longer listed as members, but many of the people are sitting on boards. Marroquin University from Guatemala is the biggest university that is part of the Atlas Network. Many different parts of George Mason University in Virginia, the public choice school, are part of Atlas. And actually many academic institutes are part of Atlas. So the blurring of the lines is that we don't only have the university here and the think tank there, but in the same umbrella organization, we have the academic research institute and the think tank under the same roof. And of course, if you look in a different way at it, not just from the individual perspective, I decide I like Manifest and I as a person support them. So I go to some meetings and share in the discussions and so on and so forth. But if you look from the perspective of these universities like Marroquin University or Buckingham University or George Mason University, you have a university and in your university ranks, you have like 50 professors who all sit on different neoliberal think tanks. George Mason University has like board members in think tanks in America, in Latin America, in Europe, in Africa, in Oceania. So it's very interesting how we see the patterns that some of these academic, neoliberalized academic spaces have a whole army of professors who sit on all these different boards. And it's actually good to know that the whole strategy to fund academic centers that people found interesting to fund and think tanks that people found interesting to fund were actually thought of in the same way. Richard Fink, the head of the philanthropy, the foundation of the Koch brothers in the United States, he developed a proposal to fund sort of like a triangle of research. On the top level is the university, then comes the think tank, then comes the campaign organizations. So basically, already in the 1980s, there was a design of philanthropic funding involving funding at university, funding in the think tank world, funding in the sort of like political campaign world, and on the bottom also funding politicians. Then they dropped this out because it smacked too much to about corruption. No? Now, if you look at the American Atlas network, which is by far the most impressive part, 250, 260 organizations, I did this graph. We see this from the beginning, where you had basically the National Multi-Issue Think Tank as sort of like the core organization, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, and so on and so forth. We see that we get an increasing specialization. So this network combines organizations that are more and more specialized. We have the whole world of think tanks that operate on the state level. In the United States, in each state, you have a state-level think tank, and they are combined by the state policy network, which coordinates the work. So it's not only separately sort of like structured, but capacity is planted in the state level and then coordinated. We have different sectors I titled influence sectors, the academic, of course, the legal sphere, philanthropic sector. Enemy observation might not fit there so well. It's something they really do. The media, of course, campaigns, teachers. So basically, this means that there are organizations dedicated to influence exactly these different areas, and not just one of them. Issue area specialization, of course, all the different fields. So not many issues in one think tank, but a think tank dedicated to a specific issue or like a limited area. And and then, of course, we have religious people who speak to the sort of like the border of religion and neoliberalism. And we have network coordinating organizations. So what we see, it's basically not just a network. Networks we think of as, you know, being consisting of all kinds of different organizations that somehow hang together but don't get too much coordination. But we see that this has evolved over time into a very complex machine that is linked in many different ways by funding, by board, cross-board membership, by projects. And of course, there must be a little bit of brains behind, you know, to think about how do we do this? How do we go for the future? The global network, of course, was about getting as many think tanks in as many countries as possible and sort of like pushing and organizing funding for these efforts. And they do these resource bank meetings in each region where they bring together funders and recipients. But this, I think the American network is really the most impressive kind of part of this, showing that the background of developments like the shift of the Republican Party from the Nixon type of Republican Party to now the Trump Party owes it to mobilization and organizing in civil society in various spaces. In the Atlas network, it's very interesting now, you have both the Trump Republicans and the anti-Trump Republicans. So, of course, this is also a space which is not unidirectional. I mean, you should not think of it as something which is centrally directed like the church or Leninist party. No, but there are centers of influence. And you can nicely see now how the Heritage Foundation, for example, has become very much pro-Trump. University of Claremont in Los Angeles has very much pro-Trump. So you can see very nicely. And then you have organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, where you see there are like pro-Trump and anti-Trump conservatives. So there's, of course, a time of, also within these camps, a time of change. And then when I went back to see what Tucholsky had actually written about, where he had written this wonderful sentence about the two chairs, and in between, I realized my memory had played a trick on me, because Tucholsky actually had not referred to different entities where you are in between, but he had referred to time. The past was gone, the military Wilhelminic Germany, and the future, in his idea, socialism, was not yet there. So time is putting us always in between, having parts of the past and parts of the future. And of course, we don't know in the meantime, and we don't have so much trust anymore, that the future is going to be good, no? And the forces that are fighting for the future are very diverse. And university and academic space is absolutely a part of this space of fighting for alternative futures, no? And the way in which they are able to influence this and claim that even this direction brings progress is open. And one of the latest manifestations, this is a long quote I need to put up, because this new movement away from neoliberal globalism to this kind of new conservatism we see with Trump, Milley, and so on and so forth, combining free market neoliberalism and nationalist conservatism, is nicely expressed by this new organization, which has a meeting in Brussels in April. And with regard to university, they say, we recognize that most universities at this point are partisan and globalist in orientation, vehemently opposed to nationalist and conservative ideas. And then they say, such institutions do not deserve taxpayer support unless they rededicate themselves to the national interest. Education policy should serve manifest national needs. So the next group of people putting their hands on university will not try to open them to as much market spaces as possible, but will actually try to get back the sort of like ideas of university, I guess, better known from earlier days in terms of serving the national and military interest. And so these struggles are never really completely over. And, you know, again, at every point, university professors will have to make these choices. You know, do they really feel they are committed to the regime of doing autonomous research and searching for the truth? Or in which ways are they also involved in projects they may not even understand? Yeah, so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You should have had a much bigger audience. This is so important. But since we are approaching Easter, I think many have prioritized otherwise. But we have taped your talk, and many listen to our podcasts. And if you now want to say something, you talk into the microphone and you say your name so that we have it on record. So please, there's room for discussion and time for questions.
Ralph Hobson, I'm an historian here, but my main job is at the Norwegian Institute of Defence Studies, which may sound like a think tank, but I'm doing my best to make sure that it's a research institute. And I was fascinated by what you've been presenting to us, because I've done some work myself on the way that American defence intellectuals and think tanks produce military theories, especially since the 1990s, which to my mind as an historian are based on faulty interpretations of historical evidence and strategic theories and so on, which doesn't seem to matter because they operate in a different environment. They're selling a product to the Pentagon. They're in competition with one another. They're in a marketplace for ideas. And whether or not their intellectual products stand up to academic scrutiny doesn't matter. So I'm fascinated that there is actually this much research on these kind of institutions, and I'd like a long list of studies from you afterwards. A couple of points which I've picked up from my own research in this field. One is the very simple, basic Marxist question. Money goes in, theory comes out. McDonnell Douglas gives $2 million to a research institute to study air power, and the think tank produces a study of air power, which says that air power can be used for everything because it's universally applicable and there are no drawbacks to it at all. Is there research of these simple interrelationships between funding and conclusions? I asked an American who studied RAND Corporation why there were so few critical studies in the field. And he said, very basically, you don't shit where you eat. People who have the competence to evaluate these military theories are dependent on think tanks for most of their job prospects. So they don't criticize the products. And then, therefore, there is less criticism of this or investigations of money in, theory out. there is a second point, and I'll finish. What I find with defence intellectuals is that they say, I don't care if you prove to me that my use of the Wehrmacht or Blitzkrieg or Clausewitz is not correct according to current historical conclusions. I don't care about that because I'm basing my theories, my conclusions, on these, what you call false interpretations. And my conclusions are what I'm selling in the marketplace. So I don't care whether it's academically incorrect or not. And this is a problem with think tanks, which you have identified. But it's also a problem, especially in the US, for universities, because American universities are the closest thing we have to a free market in academic ideas. And I sincerely hope that there are studies of this, because I get the impression, not being an expert, that, say, in English literature, universities promote professors with weird or special theories because they attract students and then attract monies, so that you have the same mechanisms at play at American universities, and they produce a lot of very weird theories. So the idea that these market mechanisms which distort theories in the think tanks do not operate at universities is, I think, suspect, but I have no research to back that up at all.
Thank you very much. You want to answer, comment this?
Well, maybe just, absolutely, I guess everybody will very easily recognize that this kind of perfect ideal of the university just committed to the plain research that gets us to the truth is, of course, not correct. I mean, we know of many different factors that mitigate against sort of like an open such a sort of like mono causal interpretation of what goes on, the attraction of students, the need to go with funder interest. I mean, Norway, Sweden, Germany, we all have the state science political establishments that make very consequential decisions on where funding goes. I think in Germany, every third grade engineering department is better funded than most of the social science departments. I mean, there's if you look at European research and policy decisions, of course, I think we should just spend actually more time on studying exactly these kind of issues that are relevant for the way in which university develops, the knowledge field develops, so to speak. And I think these projects that try to establish, I mean, to know if the plain orthodox Marxist argument, so to speak, has valid, we need to know much more about the funding. I mean, if it's very hard to understand funding patterns at university, then it's very hard to establish the link. I mean, in the think tank sphere is exactly the same. In the United States, we know more about the funding of the think tanks than in Europe. In most European countries, you don't have any need, the think tanks have no need to publish who funds them. Now, I can, of course, look at the board links. That's what we do. If I see that somebody from a corporation sits on a board, then I assume that there's also money flowing. And I mean, they have to basically convince me that this is not the case, that it's just an individual. But I mean, you know, from many areas, we know that exactly the people who have the money get seats on boards and help directing the think tank. So Civita, I don't know whether Civita is publishing their funding. They should, to my mind. And then it would be visible that Petro, whatever, the various Norwegian companies funded, and then we can talk about, you know, if some of the what Civita is producing is related to such funding. But I mean, the influence is more than just the funding. That's sort of like the other message I hope people get, that on the one hand, I have, of course, influence from funders like ExxonMobil funded a lot of climate denialism, no? But then actually, neoliberals, organized neoliberals, who are believers in market solutions, who are against state, state planning methods and so on and so forth, they actually don't need funding from ExxonMobil to oppose regulatory policy in climate policy. They dislike all kinds of regulations because they are convinced sort of like about neoliberal market approaches. it's a basically a confluence sometimes in policy of a certain ideology, worldview, and what then comes in terms of the academic program that is linked, and the interests of certain groups of business. And of course, the group of business, I mean, in Atlas Network, you have fossil companies, but actually the fossil segment in the Atlas Network is not even very large. Much larger is, for example, I think the segment of finance. But then, of course, finance is not just finance. Finance is finance for fossil or for other purposes. So we need to basically, in the research, we need also to be aware of this simple, sort of like simplistic positivist thing, the defense industry, no? I mean, what belongs to the defense industry? Super complicated. I mean, it's a lot of dual use, a lot of linkages, and but I mean, you described this extremely well. And for example, I would wish that we would not only see the ways in which, of course, the super big American military sector has influence both at university and at the think tank sphere, but we would take a closer look in Europe as well. The new NATO think tanks that have been set up about 10, 15 years ago are now operating in many different countries, funded by many different countries, and probably very closely tied also with firms. And I'm afraid that there's not a lot of research going into this kind of new military industry complexes in Europe. And so sometimes it's easy to talk about the United States because, funnily enough, we also have quite a bit more information than on US things than we have on Europe.
Just one further point. I mean, Americans, as you say, during the critical 1960s, they were the people who taught us that where you stand depends on where you sit. And you are influenced by your position, and that influences the ideas that you produce. And as a result of that, if any of us see any research on links between smoking and cancer, which is funded by Philip Morris, we disbelieve it. We know, because of what Americans have done in this field, we know that that kind of research is tainted. But we don't have the same immediate skepticism with regard to a lot of other fields, which is very strange. And I say it especially in the field of the production of military theory, but as you say, it's all over the place.
We are happy with this discussion so far, so
Anders Johansen here. I'd like to know, to understand better what is in it from the professor's point of view. What can compensate for the loss of autonomy? Isn't there a certain risk of being discredited in the eyes of your colleagues, or losing prestige by being hired in by these think tanks? Can you develop on that?
I think, of course, the if there is critical publicity around involvements of academics in sort of like ambivalent, if not dubious, research projects, then of course that can also lead to a backlash and pressure. It's amazing to my mind. We, on the other hand, the university, of course, in a way, the very commitment to pluralism at university protects you also a little bit from, there's lots of people who kind of have, get promoted on all kinds of weird theories, and yet they have their space. I mean, that's why university is nevertheless, despite being pushed maybe in many ways in wrong directions, is nevertheless also still a space of academic freedom, no? And the protection of academic freedom is actually also not an irrelevant issue area, like the protection of journalism and sort of like all the kind of mechanisms we have in society to actually have a critical discourse, no? And that's why I find it, university space is, of course, enormous. I mean, we have this huge expansion of university, and it's also the needs at universities is very diverse. I mean, basically, so it's very hard to mark out just exactly one direction in which things develop, no? I mean, we can see broadly then in the old days we had many more sociologists and political scientists, I guess, in the field of development research. Now it's been shifted in Germany very much in the direction of economics. And these kind of things we see. But then actually the people who are in economics and talking about development sometimes are a little bit different from the other economists. And but I mean, the core question, of course, there's... on the one hand, I'm not sure how much money people get if they sit on a think tank board. That, I mean, in the United States, the transparency around think tanks requires think tanks to say how much money they pay for the people who work in the think tank. And I mean, I think in terms of regulation of think tank space, we would do well if we would just have what is already existing in the United States, very much like in the lobby transparency regulations. Europe and Germany and other countries in Europe were basically far behind what has been established in the US. And now we have a fairly better transparency regulation for lobbying, but we don't have it for the funding of think tanks, for example. Because, of course, it's very easy. I mean, if, for example, if you are a tobacco company or an oil company, and you know there is a challenge coming up in the near future in terms of regulatory approaches that may undermine your business model, and you have you have a huge problem in ocean mining, you know, what do you need? I mean, you need basically people who are competent, who are really trained, who kind of can make the case and cannot easily be sort of like dismissed. So that's academics. No, you need the academic competence to make a case. That is not that alone is not enough, because an academic is only an academic. He or she publishes something, and if I'm a strategic person at a corporation and I know there is all kinds of policy conflicts coming up, I need to know that my academic, in quotation mark, is prepared to say certain things, not only in a hidden academic journal, but also in something that is publicly available. What do I do? Well, I can, for example, utilize a think tank, give the think tank $100,000, little money by way of purchasing academic studies that usually come at the millions, no? And bring somebody in there who may not actually be the expert in the field, but who will be prepared to use the information available and prepare it in ways that can be circulated, no? Next thing comes, there is a court case coming up. And in the court case, I need a lawyer who is competent in negotiating this with the judges and with the other parties, no? What does this person need? Well, he needs, of course, evidence. So he brings in the hidden jewels from the academic at university and the more widely circulated material from the think tank, which has, in the meantime, been also published in journals, in the media, in sort of like has been discussed maybe in some expert circles in TV. So basically the think tank is this space where I can bring in, I mean, on think tanks you find a lot legal people from law firms on boards, people from university on boards, people from other NGOs on boards, people from the media on boards. And this think tank space is basically a wonderful space from the perspective of strategic policy making to actually make the relevant links. So I think of the think tank as basically the capacity. I mean, you have on the one hand, you have money, but money buys all kinds of things, but money doesn't, you know, get organized all these things. So the think tank has become sort of like a key institution to basically facilitate the combination of the sources of power. I mean, thinking less of Marx, more of Weber, as sort of like the variety of sources of power. We can think of intellectual power, academic power, all kinds of competencies that you need to bring in. This is very relevant because sometimes if you have a good combination of academic and other media capacity, you can actually also out-compete a very powerful organization. I mean, you don't sometimes need the big money of ExxonMobil to achieve a policy success if you're better than Exxon in combining the academic relevance and the sort of like publicity relevance. sort of like goes both ways. I mean, on the one hand, you can certainly, I mean, we see so many people on think tanks from this sort of like business world, so it's very hard to imagine competing against it. But on the other hand, they also, it's very interesting that you need all these capacities, you know. The money alone will not get you this success. So, and for the individual, well, I mean, some of them get pretty well paid, I guess. And sometimes you get actually a good reputation because, you know, people need to get published in your own language, but then who translates it, who secures the publication in another country? Hayek's famous Road to Serfdom, no? I mean, if it would have been published in an odd German, in Eugen Rentsch Verlag in the Switzerland, without getting into Reader's Digest, maybe he would not have become the famous intellectual he was, no?
Yeah, thank you. Peter Haugen, I'm a natural scientist, oceanographer here, but I actually, 5 years ago, went more over to the government institute, Institute of Marine Research, which provides a lot of scientific advice. So I'm from a different field. But I thank you very much for this very, very illuminating talk. Starting with the relationship between university and other actors. Yes, you can say that the university has a diversity and has allowed everybody to grow, but the last quote, or one of the later quotes you had on how the think tanks in, neoliberal think tanks in the US try to influence the future of the university system, what kind of things are going to be funded and should be funded there, I think should tell universities that, you know, this state of the universities may not continue into the future unless one engages also in these science policy and policy arena. So I find this discussion you have of, you know, from the university on the one side and all the intermediate sort of ways of working to the think tanks as very, very illuminating. Also in my field, which is more environmental field. So I follow, you know, climate negotiations, Convention on Biological Diversity, the various players who influence there. So not only neoliberal think tanks, but the environmental NGOs, the philanthropy world, the links between, corporations, finance, not least finance. We talk about finance mechanisms for protecting nature, but where there are different interests at play and different voices. And I see again and again that, you know, if in order to have a voice that is heard in these fora internationally, you know, a university working the traditional way doesn't get there. So you have this difficult decisions, you know. I get asked from an environmental NGO to be part of something, and I do it, and I wear different hats, and I do that all the time. But to approach a question, you know, if you can say maybe something more about the relationship between corporations and philanthropists in this space. I noted you had World Economic Forum on both your lists.
Yeah.
And I've never been there, but that's a player which is quite interesting, I think, in this field, because it's really the rich people of the world. But they're also running some agendas that look quite, progressive. And you have other organizations like the UN Global Compact, which is like something like 70,000 companies around the world who try to create an agenda and have sort of a UN status, but not being really part of the UN. This is a very complex field to be in, and for any university professor to engage, it takes, you know, years to get out. So learn how to proceed and what are the correct ways of working. If you can have a little bit more a reflection on this spaces here beyond the neoliberal, thanks to the others, how to relate to them, I would be thankful.
That's of course that's very important because the. It's also a debate about neoliberalism itself, because in the climate policy field, of course, we talk about the privatization of climate governance. So all these organizations that you mentioned, like the Global Compact and the World Economic Forum and the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, which was founded to support the Rio conference, they were basically... They're very much in line with the shift of climate policy from a stronger state-led and state-dominated policymaking mode to a much more sort of like private sector oriented policymaking mode. So in a way, the Schmidt-Heine approach, the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, has succeeded to basically bring the shift that we now have in the Paris agenda. The goals are there, 1.5 degree, so no question about the ambition of the climate policy goals, but the policy instruments have been shifted very much in favor of market-based instruments. That's basically one of these questions, you know, like in the fluorocarbon debate in the 1980s, very successful getting rid of one of the disastrous climate and environmental killing gases, you know. It was clear you need to just cancel it, no? In oil, in CO2 emissions, we trust that the market solutions will somehow do it. And the whole discussion about that you simply have to stop fossil emissions is off the table, basically. And we know how complicated the reality is, that under social pressure, the Yellow Vest movement in France, the agrarian protests, agricultural protests in Germany, the market mechanism driving the prices for CO2 emissions up, creating social protest by classes negatively, adversely affected. Politicians react by rising up the right-wing populist vote. Politicians react and say, oh yeah, we have to somehow stop this increase in CO2 emission prices. It's very interesting how these mechanisms are created that then seem to are presented as the perfect solutions, because the market mechanism solves the problem much better than allegedly than the politician. But then in reality, we end up in a complete mess, and suddenly the politician who then regulates the price and lowers the carbon emission price is not attacked anymore for being an interventionist. No, so basically the movement of a lot of more mainstream people in the field, also many corporations, is in a way a part of an effort to what has been called the privatization of climate governance. But the network here, the Atlas network, still opposes the agenda of Schmidt-Heine, the World Business Council, and the Global Compact. They are basically even more radically opposed against climate governance as such. They are even afraid of the implications. You know, of course, there are some implications even of the privatized climate governance. And these forces, we call them, for lack of a better name, fossil reactionary, because they would actually like to preserve as much of the fossil regime as possible for as long as possible, whereas the other side is sort of like committed to shape the transformation, maybe slow it down, maybe also you know, make it business friendly, but they are at least sort of like playing along with the, but we can absolutely talk more about this. This is a new project. We have to try to combine data sets to see which corporations are sort of like on this pro-Paris agenda, and which, and if there's no overlap with the people who are sitting on our agenda here, because then we have two cleavages, no? And if there's overlap, it's again interesting, because then it's maybe different strategies. But empirically, it's super complicated, because we're always talking about thousands of firms, corporations, philanthropies. But the philanthropies are very central to these competing efforts. There's very clear climate philanthropy and anti-climate philanthropy.
Yes, my name is Ulf Gosel. I'm a sociologist. And of course, I'm aware that there is a literature on think tanks. And there are probably more forums, small forums like this one. But how do you assess the general debate on Wertfreiheit? Is there any large discussion about these issues in general, for instance in Germany, or for that matter in the United States?
I mean, I guess in academia you can easily be confronted if you write a book and publish it with a kind of a publisher that is considered not so academic, no? Harvard University Press and Oxford would be very good publishers, Pluto and, you know, some of these left-wing presses then are considered. And then I hear often that the accusation against Wolfgang Streeck, for example, who is in his old age become quite a radical, and he is then accused to be opinion strong. So the mild way of saying that somebody is no longer committed to the academic ideal is to be opinionated, to be opinion strong rather than fact strong or theory strong or something like this. It's very interesting how these debates in mild form say, well, you're an idiot, you're trustworthy. I think it's always worthwhile remembering that Weber's Werturteils debate was directed against the German National Conservatives. I mean, it was very much a political perspective at the time. So we need to, such debates need always to be historically contextualized, because he never said you should not have, as an academic, a strong, you know, also your own political and philosophical opinions. But I think that was what I was referring to, that the mode of operation is different from a question-driven research, research that is committed to a certain practice. So I can be a convinced Marxist, and yet I can still do good research, because I'm not saying I know my answer before I do my research. No, so it's basically the question, if I can cater, if I can tailor my set of normative concerns and beliefs, and my theoretical and methodological concerns, if I can tailor them in ways that don't produce results without doing basically the research, no? And if that's possible, then it's actually rich to have different approaches, like neoliberals like Ronald Coase. I mean, if you think of the history of the post office, something profane as the post office, most of us would know Thurn and Taxis, you know, some feudal business model, but then the state. No, the state was basically the postal office is the most statist of all big infrastructures. No, Ronald Coase actually, in his neoliberal beliefs that something was wrong with that narrative, sat down and went to the archives and searched for the history of the post office. And what did he find out? He found out that the universal price model, that was of course a key of the success of the postal system, a low universal price, not a market price. He found out that British tea merchants had first pioneered this price system. And then he also found out that Sir Christopher Hills, when he proposed the penny mail model for the UK mail, had proposed it not for the whole of the Commonwealth for which it was implemented, but only for mail within big urban centers. And then it became sort of like a concept that the politicians simplified and applied to the whole Commonwealth. And so, but Coase, with his interest in market mechanisms and entrepreneurship, his drive to research this was actually wonderful, to discover new things that people who think of the postal system as a state system would probably not have seen. And so I think that the normative dimension can actually be a very important driver of research. And it only is very important to have the Werturteils Debatte in mind in thinking, yes, I should not know my answers before I even start the research. No, I mean, I need orientation to research, but I should mitigate against being, you know, the fallacy of only selecting on, have a very biased sort of like way of selecting evidence. But there's not such a big debate on this anymore. I think it's much more about research impact.
Okay, it's a long debate. Let me remind you that in the book The Road from Mont Pelerin, you refer to the program of Hayek, the first program in 1947, and point 10, where he says that complete intellectual freedom is so essential to the fulfillment of our aim that no considerations of social expediency must ever be allowed to impair it. So he sort of implanted in the think tank or thought collective idea that you needed scientific legitimation. And many of these professors you see at Civita are just doing that, legitimating Civita. And when I talked to the founder of Civita before she started this process, she said, why cannot I create an institute when all the social science institutes in Norway are biased? Why cannot I have a goal-oriented institute for the liberals, which will be science-based? And many of these professors that you see in Civita, they are much more used in the public sphere than any other professors. They are interviewed in the radio, they're on TV. They tell us that the market is the most efficient way of organizing things, or even though you never have had any proof of that, it's science.
but it's not proved. They tell us that during the crisis, economic crisis in 2009, they came on the radio and TV and told us that democracy is a threat to economic recovery. So they and they gave it scientific
legitimacy,
flair of science, and they became famous and they became used, and they got research money afterwards because they were so well known in the media. And the research, our research council, influences very, is very much influenced by the media. So, well, just a few comments on that. We are approaching the end of the
morning devotional,
the morning debate, the morning. but if there is any other,
yeah, can I just pick you up on that. What you say? I'd just like to play devil's advocate. You say that this lady founded Civita because the social sciences were all left wing or whatever. Well, couldn't one go one step further back and in the causes of this and ask? I don't know if it's relevant, but the U.S. cultural wars, which have been going on for at least 40 years now, perhaps started when the right got the White House under Reagan and the left got the universities. And since then, American universities, completely dominant in all fields, have been producing a lot of rubbish, which you will find a lot of in the bookstores here. Isn't the founding of Civita perhaps a reaction to the products coming out of the American cultural wars, which are not perhaps relevant to all countries or even to the disciplines in which they are produced? There's a lot of rubbish ideas coming out of American universities, and they should be opposed, and they are not necessarily opposed within the universities. So think tanks could be a corrective to that.
It's hard for me to comment on the American debate, but in Norway, the Civita was considering social sciences mostly done by leftist people on the left side, but not necessarily, the content was not necessarily unscientific. So that was, maybe.
This is old. This is new.
No, that's an interesting. You have any comments on this, Anders?
I know Naomi. Yeah.
It's a hard nut to crack. but it's worthwhile discussing. Talking about what Peter talked about, the other side of think tanks, as you see on the German, as you saw about Germany, 2/3 of the advisors who moved between think tanks and ministries were on the neoliberal side, and all the think tanks that we know on the middle and the left side were engaged in environmental issues and so forth are disorganized. They are not connected as the neoliberal think tanks are. So there is a very skewed world we're living in that respect. Yeah, Anders.
Well, there's a lot of rubbish coming out of American academia. For instance, the deconstruction of the idea of truth out there and reality has paved the way for certain developments in the political field about alternative truths and so forth. So, and this is, should be a challenge, at least as much for the left as for the right political forces. It's primarily a challenge to critically minded people. But of course, you're right. That's part of the issue. But I'm not sure whether Civita has been a very efficient corrective for this kind of rubbish.
Thank you, Anders. One of our concerns, following up, Anders, is that how few academics are really critical of what comes out of the think tanks. Instead of joining them, we should criticize them and take serious what their foundations and criticize the ideas they build on. which they have some presuppositions that they call truth, and that they sort of build on. And we should be much more aware of these things and criticize it more. But that does not happen at our universities, in Norway at least. Rather, it's this politeness, this academic politeness that penetrates everything. So thank you all for being here on this day before the big holiday. And thank you particularly to Dieter for coming back to Bergen after so many years. And I hope you will succeed with your continuous work.
Thank you.
Du har nå lyttet til et opptak av Forum for vitenskap og demokrati. Lyden har blitt redigert for korte nedpauser og skarpe lyder, og for å normalisere volym. Ansvarlig for opptaket, redigering og podcasten er Ingjeld Pilskog, førsteamanuensis ved Høgskolen på Vestlandet.